What's up? This is Mike Fenoya from Amigos, and Amigos Podcast is In the Loop, the legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Check out OsirisPod.com and stay in the loop. Hey, what's up? Welcome back to Amigos. It's your host, Mike Fenoya. Hope everybody's doing good. Thanks for coming back for another one. We are sharing the Still Chasing interviews done in preparation for the podcast series Still Chasing, looking at fanaticism and especially searching for moments provided by live music, particularly the music of the Grateful Dead and Phish. And I've been bringing you the full interviews here on Amigos. And today I'm bringing you another one. Professor of Gerontology at University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Very, very interesting. Rebecca Adams. So I will be bringing you our talk. David Gans recommended I reach out to her, and I'm very happy that I did. So we'll get to that in a minute. Before I do, let's get the business out of the way. If you're on iTunes and you're listening to Amigos, give us a 5-star review and a rating. And head over to Twitter at Amigos Pod, AmigosPod. Same on Instagram, and also on Twitter and Instagram at Mike Fenoya, MikeFinoia. For stand-up comedy dates, you can go to MikeFinoia.com and watch Impractical Jokers, Inside Jokes, my TV show on True TV. So, if you're not privy, I released a podcast series called Still Chasing here on the Osiris Network, home to unbelievable podcasts about music and society and culture. The podcast was about my turning 40 and looking at the moments I chased following the band Phish. I did it with my friend Mr. Michael Shields, who is another podcast host here on Osiris. Here's a trailer for the program if you haven't heard it yet.
Hey, what's up? This is Mike Fenoya. I'm a stand-up comedian, producer for the TV show Impractical Jokers, and host of the podcast Amigos. I'm also helplessly addicted to the band Phish. For over half of my life, I've been freakishly obsessed with this band, the community, and the endless moments they've provided us.
Dude, they're kind of like an inspirational rock band.
Now, at 40 years old, I'm taking a look back at over 2 decades of obsession to find out what drives this addiction, what makes them so special, and why I happily continue to make this band a priority over family, bills, and obligations. And before you judge me, take a look at yourself. You'd skip work for a fantasy draft or lie to your grandmother for a Walking Dead marathon, so back off. My thing just happens to be live music, freaking out under the lights with 20,000 of my best friends, jumping and celebrating, criticizing, traveling, planning, and partying.
I just saw a woman looking for a kid named Nugget.
Nugget! Still Chasing is a podcast series hosted by myself and my friend, author and podcaster Michael Shields. Together, we dig through our old college trunk and share our perspective on what initially drew us in, what keeps us intrigued, and continues to stoke the fire.
Just was, as you noted, so compelling that we began to organize our lives around it.
Through personal interviews with pivotal members of the community, friends, and forefathers, we not only take a look at ourselves, but we dive into the philosophy and beauty of fanaticism.
For whatever reason, Phish and the way that they play, the way they mix up their shows, was a perfect sort of field to plant a lot of dreams in.
Still Chasing provides a first-person investigation into the mind of a fanatical fan.
It features hilarious behind-the-scenes stories about the band.
Trey pulled up to a tent and got out and opened the zipper of the tent and put his head in and said, "Festival's canceled! Go home!"
Where a love of a band takes you places you never imagined.
And I headed up there with a bunch of friends and I got the chance to meet and befriend author, counterculture icon, Mary Prankster, Ken Kesey.
Learn why we just can't stop chasing.
I want to keep coming back because I'm feeling a pure sense of happiness and bliss, and nothing can take it from me.
Still Chasing is brought to you by Osiris and is available January 15th wherever podcasts can be heard.
Won't you step into the freezer?
thank you everybody who has listened and have given their feedback and told me how happy they were to relive their childhood. And it was an honor doing it. And I look forward to many more seasons of this project. But in doing this, I reached out to some folks, and David Gans, I was speaking to, he told me you should really reach out to Rebecca Adams. And Rebecca did this incredible, talk about a cool professor. I wish I had Professor Adams when I was in college, but she brought a class on tour and took a look at how a community can survive under the definition of a community being something that moves, because up until that point, pre-internet, the community, definition of community was something that kind of was standstill. But the dead, their roving itinerant way, brought the community, you know, with them, and the community decided to follow. So it was really interesting to speak to Professor Adams because of the way that we kind of looked at it from a more, you know, educational standpoint, from a physiological standpoint, comparing the lots, the growth of the fish scene, and coming out of the dead scene, and a lot of interesting points of view that I think maybe a normal everyday fan wouldn't necessarily have. So it was really cool to chat with her, and I appreciate Rebecca for her time. And this is the interview. So I really hope you guys enjoy it. And keep sending the messages. I appreciate it. I hope you're enjoying all of the interviews. And keep on chasing. We'll catch you on the flip side, everybody. Peace.
Okay. So in the summer of 1989, I took a class of students on tour with the Grateful Dead. And we went to most of the summer tour. And it's actually two classes. The students took both of them. But the dad allowed us to bypass mail order and sold us a block of tickets and kind of endorsed the class in a way.
Wow.
That led to me realizing that I needed, you know, that I wanted to write about the topic. And so I kept doing research and shows. And David, the way I got to know David was he and I started working together at shows because he was interviewing people for his radio show and I was doing research. And so he would record the interviews and I would interview people. And then he would use some of the footage on his shows and I would have it for my research archives. And so we went to a lot of shows together doing that, mainly in California, because, of course, that's where David was. Yeah. But that's how I got to know David. And I did do a book, an edited book called Deadhead Social Science. It was co-edited with one of my graduate students that I took on tour, Rob Sardiello. And I have a book manuscript I wrote all the way back in 1990 that I was advised not to publish if I wanted to be promoted to full professor.
Really?
So it never was published, although I now have a research leave for next year and will actually write that book, or I should say rewrite it, because now, you know, it was written in the moment, it, you know, before Jerry died, and now a lot of what I talked about in that book in present tense is now in the past. And a whole lot of what I wrote about in the book laid what I was describing was happening in the community. The whole basis of the book was, how is it possible for a community to form around a band that moves from place to place? Because at that time in the academic literature, community was considered tied to a place. It was before the internet and all that took over. So, I mean, the internet was barely starting. We had Usenet, you know.
Right,
so,
yeah.
You know, you must remember Rec Music G Dead.
Yeah.
The argument I made in that unpublished book was actually about why it was possible for there to be a community. And I now realize if I had published it, it would have predicted that the community would have continued after Jerry died, which it has, of course. So, yeah. Anyhow, that's the background. And okay. But for 89 and 90, I was in every paper and magazine and Deadhead TV and MTV and Entertainment Tonight. Yeah. I was like the Deadhead professor in the media, and I've continued to be a resource for that. There was a video also. It was called Deadheads in American Subculture, and the woman who went on tour with me, the other faculty member, was a media person, a cinema person, and she did a video that was released on PBS, and they used it for their fundraiser for about 10 years.
So, wow.
So I was high profile in the late 80s and early 90s. And last year, I just did a series at my university to celebrate 30 years since the class. We had the class come back that went on tour in 89. David Kamen was on the program. Jesse Jarno, some other people. But we had all these local Greensboro people involved, started a Dead cover band. Anyhow, it's just, so I've recently had a reemergence as a Deadhead professor.
So. Wow, that's wonderful. And it's so great to have a professor that is so forward thinking. I mean, geez, that's really wonderful. I mean, we had to read Shakespeare, and that was the most exciting thing that we got to do. So
well, this was, I mean, it truly was a risk, but it paid off. And at this last conference, my current chancellor said I was, he was really impressed with what I had done. But of course, he's a rock and roll chancellor. He started the Black Musicians Network or something while he was in graduate school. So he's very supportive. It's a different time than it was back then.
Yeah.
But just, for who I am now, if you need to say who I am now, I would say that I'm Rebecca Adams, the sociologist who took the class on Grateful Dead tour in the summer of 89, and that I'm currently in the gerontology program at UNCG. Because I am writing now about aging music fans. I've always been a gerontologist, and so my Grateful Dead fan / friendship research, which I did when I was young, is now merged with my aging research, and I'm studying aging music fans, or at least writing about them.
Now, what does that mean, an aging music fan? Are we all aging music fans, or is that something that when you hit a certain age, you're considered an aging music fan?
Well, we are all aging.
Yeah. Some faster than others, unfortunately.
Right. That's actually a very astute observation. But I'm writing about, I have a young collaborator, Justin Herman, who is also a professor at UNCG, an assistant professor. And he and I are writing about we're writing about the challenges that face older adults when they want to have continuing engagement with live music, and kind of the challenges that are posed by the accumulated effects of aging. Both those that are just normal parts of aging and those that are special to music fans, such as hearing loss, muscular skeletal issues from dancing on cement in your bare feet,
yeah,
all those
absolutely.
Kinds of things.
Yeah.
And just about how people are handling that. And quite frankly, we don't have real data. We're both writing about this from our experiences and from our encounters with other fans. But basically, we're writing about how people handle it, either by relocating to be near an accessible venue, or by changing their show habits. You know, maybe they don't go to the whole run and only go to one show, or maybe, you know, they hold back a little bit on full-fledged involvement, but backed in certain ways to make it possible for them to still do live music. And of course, when it becomes impossible, we now have the internet and all sorts of recorded music and opportunities, you know, to see music in your own home. But we've also wrote about the possibility of there being continuing care communities. They're called CCRCs by gerontologists, but a continuing care community focused on the Grateful Dead, kind of like Jimmy Buffett now has the whole string of retirement homes. Yeah, those are CCRCs. And we basically argue that being a deadhead wouldn't be enough to make you want to live with a group of other deadheads, but that there are subgroups of deadheads, as there have always been, who share more than just a love of the music, like Grateful Dead scholars, or Jewish deadheads, or people who have chosen to follow a particular dead derivative band that has a smaller community. And so we argue that we think that this could actually happen in the near future, that, you know, people could decide to do that instead of, you know, moving to a CCRC with a particular religious faith focus, or, you know, certain other amenities. So that's what we're writing about now.
So in your first study, what is it that you, you know, summarized about the how can a community sustain around the music? What is it that you learned when you brought these students out on the road and did these interviews?
Right. Well, it really, taking the students on the road was just the beginning. I collected data for about 5 years after that, and I won't go into all the different ways I collected data, but I sent out lots of questionnaires to various groups of deadheads. I received a lot of letters when Jerry Garcia died, 150 letters.
Wow.
That I analyzed about, you know, that transition. That's another thing I wrote about what happened immediately after Jerry died and how the community kind of regrouped. The original, I would basically say that my original argument that's in the book that I will be reworking, my original argument was that the first step was that the music was improvisational. So people kept going back to show after show, which made it possible for them to encounter the same people over and over. A touring act that just plays the same show each night, the Dead improvised. And of course, that's a lot more common now than it used to be, but that made the Dead a little bit different back then. So there was the improvisation. And then once you got to the show, people had a map of the community in their head and went to the same places over and over again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were markers in the parking lot, like Shakedowns. And various venues had meeting places that everybody knew about, and then there were other organizational aspects of the parking lot as well. And then in the venue, of course, we knew where Jerry's side was and the fill zone was and where the tapers were. And, you know, we knew basically where Greenpeace and the wharf rats would be set up in the hallways.
Right.
And that map, you know, with some deadheads knew that, you know, they actually formed neighborhoods in the shows based on the fact that they would go to the same places over and over again and would recognize each other. And that became the basis for friendships that sometimes spilled out into their everyday lives. And then, of course, between shows, we had the symbols to bring us together. And, you know, to help us recognize each other. And there was also, because of the way the Dead had the hotline set up, and you had to know people to share the long distance phone call charges when you had to call every day to see if there was a new hotline message. and same thing with tape trading, giving away the music, you know, led to the development of tape trading networks, which also kept people in touch between shows. And so basically what I argued was that because of the improvisational basis of the music and the way that shows were usually run to be general admission so people could go to where they wanted to be, and all of these factors that led to people having repeated encounters outside of shows led to the development of friendships that became a foundation for the community and gave people a reason to go back other than the music, which of course was their original motivator in most cases. And there were also, you know, media was key, you know, Relics came out and Golden Road and Unbroken Chain and, you know, all those, Matt Dupree's Diamond News were also ways that people kept in touch between shows. One other factor was the culture of the community and the whole notion of the Grateful Dead folk tale being a kind of idea that underlied the community where people would, you know, felt responsible for everybody having a good experience and sharing things at shows. And the culture was an inclusive culture where you were not supposed to call up external hierarchies and, you know, say, oh, I'm Dr. So-and-so or whatever. Everybody was supposed to be on equal footing at the shows because that's what happens, you know, during the ritual, where magic happens in rituals is where everybody goes into a liminal space and are equal. And so you had all of these factors I've mentioned leading to people knowing each other and having friendships and helping each other have a good time. And so then you had the actual structure of the music, which I would describe as having a ritual structure, which also allowed people to feel connected to each other, and, you know, to a larger community, even beyond those who were in the shows, and increase the solidarity and feelings of connection to the experience and to each other. And in their doing, it's being a fan of this music became part of people's identity because they were connected to it and connected to each other.
Absolutely. That's really amazing. And, you know, as someone who, you know, on the next, you know, chapter of this long book of music and community and culture, Fish, now being 35 years now, going strong. And I've been seeing them since I was 15. And it's It's interesting that the similarities between the two. They're compared quite a bit musically. They're not at all musically the same. The only thing I would say that is similar is their ability to improvise and their desire to improvise and stretch a song as far as it can go and, you know, pound away at it. But what I think is amazing is that when I hear you talking about the community, where the Wharf Rats table was at the Dead, now there's the Fellowship. Which, you know, and where there was Greenpeace, there's now the Waterwheel Foundation and the Mockingbird Foundation. And there's, you know, those posts, there's Mike's side, there's Paige's side, there's, you know, everybody has their favorite spots to go. So it's very interesting that, you know, nobody handed anyone a blueprint. It kind of built itself around the music. So it's interesting to see like phase two.
Well, I beg to differ with you on one point. Deadheads handed Phish fans the blueprint. And in fact, many of the same people who began were founders of the Phish community had originally been Deadheads.
Oh, and, of course. Yes, I know.
And but so,
what I mean is that
but even down to the level of the first time I went to see Phish, there were Thank You Trey bumper stickers, which was a direct, I mean, at the time there were Thank You Jerry bumper stickers.
Yes, of course.
I actually did an interview for Park Pewterbaugh when he wrote the Phish book, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I'm in an appendix and you can look that over, but this was a long time ago I did the interview, but I basically made the point that rather than the community growing up spontaneously around Phish, it really was the application of a blueprint. And I don't think it went very well in the beginning until Phish fans owned their own community and began changing it in ways that were more compatible with that fan base. Because when Phish first started and they just moved that blueprint over, the audience wasn't ready for that blueprint. And there was a lot of trouble in the Phish parking lot. And I think that's where it came from, was that it hadn't grown up organically. I would say, in contrast, String Cheese's culture did grow up organically and was from the beginning, although certainly informed by the Dead experience, grew up in a more organic way and involved less of a transfer of a blueprint. So now looking back, I mean, I just went to Phish in Charlotte, and it's totally different than it would have been being in a Dead audience, when that was a more where the culture was more focused on being Deadheads. But you know, now the Phish community has evolved into its own organic self. But I don't think that was true in the beginning. I think they did borrow the blueprint and then adjusted it over the years.
So do you mean that when you say they, do you mean the early fans? Or
yes.
So do you think
not the band.
Right.
The band was doing its own thing.
Yep.
And the band was doing its own thing, but a lot of their fans were experienced Deadheads and already knew what had worked in the Dead community and transferred it over. And some of it transferred and some of it did not transfer well.
Well, it seems to me from what I've heard and what I've spoken to a lot of people about was, you know, around that. So I, 95, when Jerry passed, a lot of the, you know, we'll call them the outliers, the ones that were going to the Dead shows to party. And they realized the party was winding down. They said, oh, well, here's another place to go party. Let's go get on Phish tour. And it seemed like a lot of those folks were the ones that kind of maybe were the first first tenants in the fish condo, if you will. It seemed like there was a lot of people, fish had already had their core group of people that preferred them to the dead, it seemed, you know, just like any band. And, right. and you know, that's no knock on the dead at all. It's just, that was their maybe thing geographically or, you know, in their time growing up. But it seemed like quite a few folks were just along for the party. And it seems now, and I've, you know, grew up on Fish parking lot, and you're right. I mean, it seems like there was a little bit of fear when I was a kid that, is this a safe place, you know? And it seems like now it's gotten, as I'm older, it's gotten way more, I feel like it's aged with me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I did see Fish way before Jerry died. I can't remember exactly when my first Fish show was, but the first time I saw them, the audience was tiny. Jerry had not died yet.
Yeah.
You know, so I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was after I taught the class, but before Jerry died. And so I witnessed that influx and agree with you that some of the people who transferred over were probably part of the problem. But it just, the Fish scene was not yet ready to absorb the influx of deadheads, and it wasn't an easy transfer, but, you know, eventually it worked out.
Right. So. Yeah, absolutely. I think we all have our bumps and bruises from it, just like the early Dead shows probably, you know, caused the same. I was lucky enough to have the privilege of befriending Ken Kesey. I met him at a Fish concert in Darien Lake, 1997. He went on stage with the band, and I kept in touch with him throughout undergrad. And he invited me out to his farm in Oregon, and I lived with him for a week and interviewed him, which turned out to be the final interview of his life. And I published it in Relics magazine. And it was really an incredible experience to talk to him about going up on stage with them. And he talked about for 2 years, the Bozos have been missing, and we heard they were going to appear at the Fish concert. And I just recently was out in Portland, Oregon, and I visited Ken Babbs down in Eugene. And we talked about that and about the welcoming on the bus and the passing of the torch and all of that. And I remember talking with Kesey, and he said, I just like to have a place to play. You should be always in an environment where, you know, you're the star of your movie and you're able to play. And it seems like these bands, Fish, The Grateful Dead, String Cheese, they allow us to associate with the music the way we feel comfortable. And there's no judgment and there's no right or wrong. It's just a place of love and acceptance. And it's hard to stop going, I've realized. And that's something that I'm kind of researching with this is myself. I'm riddled with anxiety. I have been my whole life. And when I'm at a concert, especially Fish or a Dead & Co show or jazz, whatever it may be, I the anxiety goes away. And I really love how I feel when I'm there.
Well, I am not a cognitive psychologist, but there's also a lot of research now about the importance of listening to your preferred music for maintaining your cognitive capacity. It's not just an emotional attachment. There's actually a physical effect of listening to your preferred music. In later life, when people begin to have cognitive issues, which, you know, are not part of normal aging, but some people do have cognitive issues. And when people listen to just any music, it might have some good effect on them. But if they listen to their preferred music, which in your case might be Fish, and in my case might be The Grateful Dead, all of the different parts of the brain light up, and it frees up areas of the brain to it frees up cognitive capacity and can actually bring people back who've not been able to communicate as themselves. And so the feeling you're having is probably very real and very physical.
Yeah. And it's been from, for me personally, it started with The Who and The Grateful Dead and the music that I would listen to, Bob Dylan, my dad's records. And it just translated over to now it's even when I'm in an audience of a live concert and there's that ambient sort of buzz, that kind of humming in the room before the lights go down, that's even calming to me. And I've just turned on my phone and recorded that noise just to see if when I'm home and there's no concerts and it's a Tuesday night and I'm freaking out about bills or whatever, if I just listen to that, how it would make me feel. And it actually made me like feel better. It's weird. It's just there's something about the every essence of the live concert experience somehow just like helps me transcend all of the anxiety in my life.
Yeah, and I think that even when you have been in a live concert context where you've experienced the feelings of unity with everybody else who's there, that when you listen to the music when you're alone, it brings back those feelings of connection. You know, I don't just think when fans who have been avid consumers of live music listen to live music, I don't think it's the same for them as it is for people who have never heard the music live in a crowd where everybody is in entrainment and focused on that music.
Yeah, we definitely have a unique experience with our bands that, you know, when that first note of a new song is coming out of a jam from the previous, we're all kind of, you know, it's like showing a dog a treat. We're all kind of perked up and our ears are, you know, pointing towards the stage and we're waiting. And it's really an unbelievable feeling. And I'm very blessed, I feel, that I found live music at such a young age.
Well, I remember I once interviewed somebody, actually it was somebody I knew who through David Gans, who said to me that she had to go to every show because which show should she skip? It could be the show. And so she said she had to keep going because she didn't want to miss the show. And that is, you know, the musical improvisation, I think, is core to the kind of experience that you're discussing.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's why, of course, the Dead's model of touring and improvising and, you know, not playing the same show over and over again has become so widespread.
You know, it's very interesting that you say that about the show. And I'd like to talk with you about that for a second, because I think we all have our, I like to call it our holy shit moment, where the band, whatever it is, whatever strikes you, whether it's monster truck racing or reading a comic book or going to a Grateful Dead concert, the thing that gets you to that place. In our lives, I feel like we all have this kind of like holy shit moment, and it's like I don't want to miss one thing that this does. I don't want to miss one episode of The Sopranos. I don't want to miss one Fish concert. I don't want to miss one Grateful Dead concert, because we're always chasing that show. What do you think it is about that? Is there ever really that show? I mean, I joke around with my friends about how if Fish plays this song, I quit. And then they'll play that song that night, and I pretend to like, all right, that's it, good night, and I like pack up and leave. But it's just, there's never going to be that show. I know I'm going to see this band until I'm they stop or I stop.
Well, what I meant by that show was just the show that provided people with a, you know, an especially poignant transformational experience. And there just isn't any way to predict what night the bands are going to perform at that level. And, I mean, that's really what she was saying.
Right.
Was I have to keep going back to every show because it could be the one that everyone wishes they were at. You know?
Yeah. So, would you agree that some, you know, let's say a Tuesday night might be one person that show, and the following, you know, a year later could be somebody else's that show. We all have, I think it's so incredible that there are sometimes there's so many people who I'll talk to after a concert and they'll go, yeah, that show was okay. And, you know, I'm like, that was one of the most unbelievable shows I've ever seen. And it's so interesting how we kind of have that, you know, we all have those, you know, what am I trying to say? We all have those like, you know, triggers that get tapped, and it's like, oh yeah, that one happened to do it for me. I love that that's the way, you know. You never know what show is that show for someone. It's really neat.
Right. And I do agree, you know, I totally agree that part of the experience is very individual, and any two people can perceive a given show very differently. But there are also shows where lots of people all at once.
Yeah.
And those are the shows that everyone wishes that they had attended.
Right. The first Dark Star in how many years? The first Saint Steve? Yes, of course. When there's the
right
bust outs and when the band's playing right and they, you know, I tend to find that when I'm watching the band goofing off and having a good time, that's when I tend to have the best time. It's when they're nice and loose.
Uh-huh.
That seems to always be the ones that make me feel like they're having a good time too, you know?
Right.
And it breaks
down
that
definitely wall. Does affect people's experience. When the band is getting along, I think it makes it easier for the audience to feel connected to the experience. I definitely think that makes a difference too, but I have to say I was blessed by being in the audience during many bust outs, and yeah, those are really special moments.
They sure are. They really, really are. I mean, you know, there's one specific moment that stands out to me as, you know, Fish never really, I mean, Bob Weir has come out and played with them a couple times. Bill Kreutzmann has, so's Phil. August 9th, 1998, at Virginia Beach Amphitheater, they covered Terrapin Station as an encore. And it was, I don't know if you ever listened to it, but if you have the chance, it's on YouTube and it's all over the place. And it was a very, very beautiful cover. And it was one and done, never done again. And I don't think anyone even thinks about them playing it again, but I was honored to be there. And I was, you know, it really, I had tears streaming down my face, and you just saw people hugging, and, you know, the year before meeting Keezy, and there was so much overlay with these worlds. And, I was really happy about it, you know, and it was done in like a respectful way. And it was not,
uh-huh,
you know, it was a nice, it was just a very nice moment. And everyone left there kind of, you know, 2 inches above the ground that night.
That's, you know, the, I was going to mention, I was, one of the interesting things that happened, one of the bust outs I was at was when they brought Dark Star back after so many years
wow
at the Hampton Coliseum.
The mothership.
And, yeah, the mothership. I was also there the night that Fish was at Hampton in the space suits and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Where they said, we're going to make this place take off or something. I remember
yeah
they started the show that way. I love Hampton.
Yeah, it's the greatest place.
But I was at that you know, at the Warlock shows. And the first night, I forget what all they did, but they played Addicts. It was a bust out.
Sure.
And something else. There was something else that first night they played that was unexpected. And a bunch of people went home after that because they thought that was the big thing, right? And they were so satisfied by that show that they left. And then the next night they busted out Dark Star.
Yeah.
And they had left, so they missed the show.
I know. It's ridiculous. And it's that's the thing that somehow keeps us... That's the beauty of, like you said earlier, the beauty of improvisation and the beauty of not playing the same show every night. You know, you go catch a Steely Dan show, you're probably going to hear Kid Charlemagne, you're probably going to hear Reelin' in the Ears. You know, if you miss a show, you may miss one bust out here or there. With Fish, with the Grateful Dead, with Our World, it's like there may be a song that you've been waiting to hear for, you know, decades.
Right, and you don't know when they're going to do it.
So you never miss a show.
Right, so you never miss a show. But, yeah, there was when I was right after I taught my class, one of my students realized that I had limited experience going to other rock concerts, and so he took me to an REM concert so I could see that, you know, it was all planned and very perfunctory. And it was particularly amusing because they announced from the stage that they were doing a film, and so they were going to play one song out of order. And they didn't want anyone to be surprised by that, you know, and think that they had skipped it. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, they have to tell people they're not doing things the normal way? I just thought it was hysterical. So it turned out to be a very good way for the student to convince me that death were different. I went from, you know, an extremely improvisational context to one that was rigidly orchestrated. And if I hadn't appreciated what the Dead did before, then I certainly appreciated it after that.
And what do you think that says about the relationship between the band and the fans?
About the band and the fans,
well, there's that level of, like, you know, going for it and the, you know, ability to laugh at themselves and the forgiveness and being perfectly imperfect. REM was so nervous to be, you know, don't be mad at us, we're going one song out of order, where, I mean, our bands forget lyrics constantly and we're fine with it.
Well, I think that the topic of taking risk is addressed really well in Amir Barlev's The Long Strange Trip.
Right.
And several of the people, both members of the band and support people, talk about how important it was for the Dead to take risk. And that is certainly, you know, magic can only happen if you give it a chance.
Right.
So I think that the band trusted its... I think the bands that improvise have to trust their audience to enter into the same spirit of adventure with them in order to improvise. Because if an audience isn't going to be along for the ride, you're not going to try to take them on it. You know?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. When did you first see the Grateful Dead live?
September 20th, 1970 at the Fillmore East. I turned 18 at the show.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yes, I went to that show. I didn't realize this until a few years ago, but I went to my first show with some of the members of a band called the Outer Space Blues Band. And I had actually heard them cover the Dead a few weeks before my first show. And they are still together.
Wow. How about that? Oh, that's awesome.
Yes. Yeah, they are. I heard them just recently play at my 45th reunion, college reunion. And wow. They were a few years ahead of me in college, and they are still playing together.
That's really great. Do you enjoy, do you try to check out live music anytime you can still? Like, I mean, regardless of what, I meant like what size, like it doesn't have to be Dead & Company or Fish. Like, do you try to catch anything you possibly can whenever you can?
I just, my retirement plan is to continue to consume live music. I just bought a house in a neighborhood where I can walk to a corner where there are several small venues that have live music various times during the week. And I'm also within walking distance of the Greensboro Coliseum.
Wow, fantastic.
White Oak Amphitheater and the Blind Tiger. I basically, my retirement plan is to continue to consume live music and to hobble to it with my walker as long as I can. But of course, now we have, you know, Uber and Lyft and things like that. So maybe I can extend the amount of time I can continue to do it.
That's true.
Adios, amigo!